The story you are about to hear is true. Only the names have been changed to protect the innocent. This is the city called Healthy Paranoia, Nowhere, USA. I work in incident response. I carry an RSA token. It's awkward having an internet cop around. Don't surf any porn, somebody says, or Mrs. Y will pull your internet cache, or how's it going, Dick Tracy? How many hackers did you pinch today? And then there's always the one who wants to know how many users' email you've read. It's not much of a life unless you don't mind missing a movie or baseball game because your cell phone rings. Unless you like working Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays, and you're going to rub elbows with the elite, thieves, liars, and executive management, the class of Skid Row, and the heartbreak, SQL injection, cross-site scripting, malware, APT. Oh, you'll fill out a report when you're right. You'll fill out a report when you're wrong. You'll fill out one when you're not sure. You'll learn to live with doubt, anxiety, frustration. It was Saturday, June 29th. It was raining. I'm working the cybersecurity detail with Liam Randall. Joining us is Andrew Case, digital forensics researcher and core developer for the Volatility Framework. And welcome to Healthy Paranoia. First, we have, nice to see you again, Liam Randall. I'm always happy to have you on the show.
Pleasure.
Great. And we have a very special guest, Andrew Case.
Thanks for having me on.
Great. Why don't you tell all the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Okay, so as you covered, I think most people know me as one of the developers of Volatility, which is the most used memory forensics framework. It's open source, available on Google Code. There's also quite a bit of documentation for it online. I also co-developed Registry Decoder with Vico Marziali, which was funded by the National Institute of Justice through their digital forensics research grant program, and that's become a very popular tool now for registry forensics as well. And besides that, I guess I've done quite a bit of forensics, quite a bit of incident response, and before that I was more in the security realm doing source code audits and penetration testing, that type of work.
And you do, I actually saw you give a really good talk at RSA Security Conference, which that's almost an oxymoron. I mean, you know, everybody I think on the call has maybe been to RSA Security Conference, and a lot of times the talks are more high level and you don't get the super nerdy talk. But yours actually, I guess, had a nerd factor of 5 to 6, which is unusual. And it was very enjoyable. And that's why that's what prompted me to get you on the show, because I love the incident response and the forensics guys. Very, very interesting work. And we're hoping you tell some really interesting nerdy stories.
I will try.
I thought we'd go over, for example, I think it's important to define some terms, because I hear people mess these up a lot. You know, you hear, for example, the thing that makes me nuts is when people confuse a vulnerability assessment with pen testing. And I'll be the one to stand up in a meeting always and just say, they're not the same. A Qualys vulnerability assessment is not pen testing. I don't know how you guys feel about that. But so why don't we start with, maybe you could go over some simple terms like the difference between incident response and forensics. I know it's a fine line.
Okay, there is a difference, though, and it's important to know the differences. When people talk about forensics, they're mostly speaking of events that have some legal issue or maybe HR's involved. So you have a rogue employee that is doing something on their computer they shouldn't. They could be ripping the company off in some way, so they're stealing IP from the company, or they're trying to take existing clients and customers from the company and send them somewhere else. So these are normally matters that are resolved with inside of the company, they normally start civil. They almost always have some legal aspect to them, whether they make it to court or not. And many times forensics also ends up on the criminal side, depending on what exactly the person did or what's found on the computer once they start getting investigated. This can also sort of lead to e-discovery, which is the least technical of the three, but it's really important because that's all court, and that's when you're going through people's emails and other records that you want to use against them in court for whatever reason.
So then you would consider, what's the particular difference then between incident response? Is incident response less or more technical than forensics? Forensics is more legal?
Yeah, that's actually a pretty good breakdown. Forensics is much more standardized. There's tools that will do forensics, a lot of the forensics for you. So you can even use something like NCASE or FTK to do search terms or to find accesses to a certain document maybe that the person wasn't supposed to access. Or you can use those to say this person downloaded a file they weren't supposed to view and then they copied it out to a USB drive. And now we don't know where that USB drive was. It's not property of the company. So that was something outside of the bounds of what they were supposed to do. Incident response, on the other hand, is when someone breaks into your network or when there's a network intrusion, and that's much less formal. This is normally not going to court. You're not going to go get the guy on the other side of the world and bring formal charges against him. This is for you to figure out how someone got on your network, what they did once they were there, if they're still on your network, and what they took or what long-lasting damage they did to the network. Let's see.
No, that's good. I guess, so chain of custody, things that you hear like that are definitely more in line with forensics. Incident response is sort of maybe more of a medical analogy where that's an emergency room situation where somebody walks in and you've got to perform triage and you've got to, you know, stop the bleeding. Is that fair?
Yeah, and forensics, you know, the chain of custody, it's all very standardized. You have to in forensics, you have to document every step you do. You write what becomes a very formal report. You have to preserve the evidence for as long as, you know, the case or the trial is going on. And it has to be documented so well and the evidence preserved so well that another investigator can come behind you, read your report, be given the same evidence, and produce the same results. And if another investigator does it and those results are different, you better be able to explain why and a reason that makes sense, or that evidence isn't going to be admissible in court. And you might get disqualified as an expert. So there are serious repercussions if you don't follow what would be forensic standards pretty much to a T.
So would you say that – is it fair to say that incident response comes first because that's like the immediate response to an intrusion, and then forensics would be everything after that as you're tracking what's going on and the case?
Yes, it can be that, and a lot of times, like I said, if it's an outside attacker, someone on the other side of the world, it can stop in the incident response world, but we know very well now, people who follow security news, that many breaches are from an employee inside the network, and so then once you switch from this, this server was compromised or this data was compromised, and not only was it compromised, but it was from some employee who's a network administrator or someone in the accounting office, now you need to switch to forensics, and there's going to be a lot of legal repercussions for that you can pursue. But again, if you don't follow the standards correctly, none of that evidence will be usable.
So have you testified in court before? Are you one of those kinds of experts?
I haven't testified. I've done depositions. The cases I've done are always it's kind of cut and dry. Like, we do an investigation, we produce the report, and then the person that's being investigated or the company that's being investigated can see the report, and there's not a whole lot to argue. That there's nothing subjective in the report. Mm-hmm. So it's always been where you'll do the report, they'll take your deposition, and then they can just use that in the court without requiring you to actually sit there. And so it's kind of a weird thing. I only know very few forensics investigators who have actually sat in court because of that reason, but then everyone's used to getting deposed. So
wow. So then let's clarify. Then there's the other two parts of this that get rolled all into it as well, malware analysis and reverse engineering. And from what I understand, malware analysis is looking at the behavior of malware, of a malicious application, and then reverse engineering is a deeper dive into that. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that's very accurate. So malware analysis is normally done on the incident response side. So a server gets compromised and then you notice there's a process that's running that shouldn't, or there's code injected into another process that shouldn't be there. Maybe there's something malicious in the kernel and you need to figure out what that does. So you can extract whatever that is, the executable, the DLL, the kernel driver, put it into a sandbox environment or a virtual machine environment and see what it does. You can see the network calls that it makes. So if it's going back out to a command and control server, if it's setting up like a listening port on the local machine, you can see that. You can see writes to the file system. You can see writes to the registry. You can see hooks that it places in memory. So without reverse engineering, you can get a pretty good idea of what this malware is capable of. And this is one thing, as you said, that's really done in instant response. The only time you see really have to analyze malware in forensics is there's cases where people will say, I know this sort of illegal material was on my machine or this action occurred from my machine. I didn't do it, though, so a piece of malware did. And then you'll have to go look at the malware and say, is this malware even capable of producing the artifacts that the person is saying it is? And if it isn't, then you can immediately rule out their defense and then move on from there.
So how much in your experience, how much malware analysis do you do? What percentage of your time is spent on that?
I would say almost every incident response case we see has a piece of malware. In forensics, there was only one case we did where we had to do it. I know other people who deal with more criminal matters on the forensic side see it more, but you almost always see it during what would I consider interesting incident response scenarios. There'll be some piece of custom malware that the attackers have used along the way.
So I went through some graduate program, part of a graduate program in forensics, and I mean, no offense to you, I just realized after a year, I went, man, I really don't want to do this. It's really like, can be like watching paint dry. I mean,
yes.
I think it takes a certain personality. I mean, what's your experience with that? Is that your character? Do you like doing that or? There are parts you like more?
I definitely like the incident response more. With incident response, you're almost doing sort of R&D on the fly because there's no click button tools that are going to look and gather the type of evidence you want. So you're finding new things. Malware is using techniques that you've never seen before, so you then have to go write some code to really understand what they're doing or to find other instances of it. Forensics is much more cut and dry. It does get really boring at times.
Okay, it's not just me then. Okay.
And I know many people who do malware analysis and incident response for their full-time job and would never take a forensics case. They don't want to deal with the legal aspect of it. They think they don't want to look for, you know, deleted files. They don't want to see what time a Word document was edited. They just find all that fairly boring. So I think you're right with that assessment.
Okay. Well, Liam, you do most of your stuff is incident response if you get into that field, right?
And that's
is that
correct,
fair?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
how do you feel? I mean, is your feeling the same as mine? What do you think?
Oh, I think that there's a certain thrill of the chase. I mean, even in, you know, even with forensics, I think that there's a certain amount that's exciting. You know, once you've indexed a drive and you know, take away everything that's on the National Software Reference Library, I mean, if you're really into it, I think it can be kind of interesting and exciting.
So how much have either of you played with NCASE? What's your feeling on software like that, the more commercial types of software? I had the impression from your talk and also reading about what you work on, Andrew, that you were more the developer of that kind of software, that you would never be the kind of person to use NCASE. Is that wrong?
That's actually right. I've never used NCASE.
No way, really?
I've never used NCASE. I've never even been on a computer where it's installed.
Get out.
And I know people who do use it. I have a really good friend. She also works on volatility with us, who worked for Guidance for several years. So she knows it inside and out. We did – at one place I worked, we did have FTK licenses that we would use sometimes. But I do – pretty much all 99% of my investigation is done on the command line in Linux with open source tools. So.
Well, yeah, we kind of knew you were a badass, but as much as you don't sound like it, but, you know, I was, and I'll have to put a link to your talk that I think, are the slides up somewhere from your RSA talk?
I do have the slides up. I think you're supposed to have like an RSA login to see the video. I don't think they make those public, but I have the slides up, and I think they have the slides
okay, if not, then if they're on SlideShare or something, I want to make sure the listeners get to see it because I thought the slides were good too. When I looked back over them, I thought, oh, that's kind of cool.
So, Andrew, sometimes I find when people are writing open source software that they're solving their own problems first. You know, what was the progression that brought you to the Volatility team?
So with Volatility, it was actually I was in college. I guess it would have been my junior or something like that. We published one or two papers on Linux memory forensics, and we had wrote our own code, sort of proof of concept level, to support the research and the paper. And then when I started looking around to see what other people were doing in the field, Volatility at that time, I think only supported XP. It was just getting like Windows or maybe Vista support at the time. But it was really active. Every time, if you Googled Volatility, there was a bunch of hits about it. If you looked on forensics mailing list, people were raving about it, how they were solving investigations left and right with it. So I joined the IRC channel that they had, started talking to the developers, and then the lead, the maintainer, Michael Audie, helped me integrate what was my Linux research into the Windows side, which then gave Volatility Windows and Linux support. And then since then, we've also added Mac support to it, and then we built on top of the Linux support to support analyzing Android devices.
So you were developing for Volatility before you were employed as a forensic incident responder?
Yeah, this was during college, which at that point that was sort of my first, experience in forensics. Up until then, it was all security work that I had done.
Well, are we talking red team or blue team kind of stuff?
No, it was all red team. We did some pen tests, some application assessments, but a lot of it was more application level. So either source code audits or we reversed quite a few security products to look for vulnerabilities and bypasses.
So you're a triple threat. You can do it all. You could do like the security engineering, you can do the incident response forensics, and you can do this vulnerability assessment pen test field as well. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. Don't ask me to go administer like a Windows Server machine or something, but I could handle Linux pretty well. So.
Well, Andrew, do you feel that you have to be sort of a well-rounded person to be able to work in the area that you are because you're pivoting to so many different directions?
It definitely helps, and I've seen other people in the community sort of advocate and push for the same thing in that if you go do incident response and you've never done a pen test, you've never broke into a server through a web application, how do you really know what the artifacts you're going to find are? Or when you see those artifacts, how are you going to link that back to say, okay, I see this in the web logs, I know what this SQL injection is capable of, this means I now need to go look at the SQL server and see, what's in the column that was interacted with, or go look at the event logs there. I think it's really hard to kind of just stick with one because it's kind of hard to understand what the attackers are doing if you've never done it yourself or really seen it played out all the way.
That's interesting. What's your favorite though? I mean, I know you're working at, it sounds like it was kind of, you sort of slid into forensics and incident response. Do you like that the best?
Yeah, I think I like incident response as long as it's something interesting the best. I still like source code auditing a lot. We did a lot of fairly large applications in the time we did, like C and C++ and so on, and that was really fun finding that obscure, low-level vulnerabilities and things. But incident response would probably be my most favorite.
Wow. Do you have a Rubik's Cube, too?
No.
That you play with when you're...
No.
Okay.
So, Andrew, there's so many different ways for people to, to get involved in various projects and to, start to do these things from a career focus. Do you have any suggested resources out there for people who are interested in learning more about this? As far as, let's say that there's a network administrator listening to the podcast later, how would you recommend that they start to get experience in some of these different fields?
So in incident response, you can actually learn quite a bit online, just reading in your own time. There's obviously a number of very good training providers, but if you're trying to do this on your own, at least like if you look at Volatility, we have what's known as the community documentation on our wiki, where we have links to, it's probably maybe 200 by now, links to papers and blog posts and other resources where people are using Volatility to analyze malware or solve investigations. And we know a lot of people have read through those and learned a lot. There's forensicswiki.org, which is actually I think it's just a media wiki installation, but that has at least an article, even if it's just a stub article, on every sort of interesting artifact and investigation technique in forensics. And I know I've spent a lot of time just reading random links on there and learning different things. So there's a lot online. There's also mailing lists that you can sit on and learn a lot. There's the Windows Forensics mailing list. It's on the Yahoo servers. There's posts there almost every day. I keep the whole list archived just because if I run into something new and I search, there's almost always a reference to it from that mailing list. So there's really a lot online, even if someone's not going to want to pay for, you know, like a formal training.
Well, volatility. Is it through volatility that you do the training or on your own?
No, it's if you're talking about the pure memory forensics training, it's myself mm-hmm. and it's myself and two other volatility developers. That's a 5-day course. It's fairly intense. We take you through basically not knowing anything about memory forensics to the last day you look at one of the most notorious malware samples there is. We don't tell people the name until after because you kind of figure it out along the way. But yeah, that training, I mean, we've had people basically going back to their office or, you know, their job after and applying memory forensics, and they had only done like disk forensics before or network forensics before. So that's definitely a way to kind of deep dive into that.
So a total noob could take that class and they'd be competent at the end? Is that what you're saying?
You could be a total noob in memory forensics. There is some helpful background, particularly when you're talking about memory forensics. You're dealing with all the algorithms and data structures that the operating system uses. So if you have any sort of OS background like you would get from a computer science degree or just studying on your own, that's really helpful mm-hmm. just to know what processes are and you know what a hash table is and what a tree is. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we've had people with no computer science background. We had one person in the class who did disk forensics for 25 years or something crazy like that. He had never done memory forensics, never written a line of code. The first day and a half, he was kind of struggling along, but by the middle of the second day, beginning of the third day, he was knocking out all the labs, which was really cool to see. So
that is great. Do you like teaching the classes? Is that enjoyable for you?
Yeah, it's really fun, and being with the two other developers, we work together all the time on volatility, and then getting to do the class together is really nice, too.
Do you guys have any upcoming training sessions you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, our next one is in September, and that's actually in Amsterdam, and then we have one in, I think it's the second week of November, back in Reston, Virginia, which is kind of there's a lot of security companies out there. It's like 20 minutes outside of D.C.
Oh, that's cool.
And then I think we haven't picked the date yet, but there'll be one in January in New York. I think that's the next one.
So are those on the Volatility website, or where can I get the link and put those in the show notes for that?
We have links from on the first page of the Volatility Google code page, and then we also have our Volatility Labs blog spot, our blog, mm-hmm. and we post them there as well. We also have like well over 100 blog posts now of technical content just on memory forensics and analyzing different malware and different things you would see during incident response. And so the blog gets, I think the blog's up to like 150,000 views or something now, from people just reading different articles and learning how to apply memory forensics to their own job. So
how do you think the field has changed? Incident response, forensics. I mean, I've seen how it changed, but you're in there. So what do you think?
From the malware side, it's definitely got more sophisticated. It's interesting. So since the training was brought up, one of the things we talk about briefly within the first hour of the class is sort of the history of memory forensics and where it came from. And one of the things you see is kind of around 2005, you had like rootkit.com was there. The FU rootkit came out, one of the most notorious Windows ones. And so you kind of saw the offensive community doing a bunch of things in memory. They would change data structures in memory. You had DCOM, which is manipulating data structures and algorithms so that the kernel could still use it, but like a system administrator on a live machine wouldn't be able to see it. And forensics was way behind at that point. If you look at the forensics papers from like DFRWS and these other well-known, you know, DFRWS and those are publishing the leading groundbreaking research in forensics. And if you look like a year before that, everyone was still looking on disk. They were looking at timestamps and log files, and they would never find these new rootkit techniques.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I mean, I was kind of – it was very eye-opening for me when I saw your talk because I hadn't really touched forensics in a while. And then all of a sudden, it's all about memory. And I went, what? How did I – because I've been doing security engineering, and then all of a sudden – you know, I missed that shift. That's really interesting. That happened around 2005.
Yeah, that was, like I said, rootkit.com was the big one. Unfortunately, the site's not there anymore. There was some really cool stuff on there. And then what happened, that same conference, DFRWS, they do a yearly forensics challenge associated with when their conference is going on. And the challenge that year was Windows memory forensics. And at that point, there really wasn't a whole lot there. There were some proof of concepts. There was, you know, maybe you could find some processes in memory, but there really wasn't anything that would be considered deep memory forensics. And then in that 2005 challenge, some of the you'll see like volatility and the KNT tools from George Garner. Some of these tools that are still the most well known in memory forensics were actually developed to solve that challenge because there was nothing else there, and those tools still exist and have been built on since then. But until that time, forensics was just lost because you know the attackers knew to avoid the disk. And there wouldn't be evidence there. Also, that's when Metasploit came around, mm-hmm. and one of in the Uninformed journal, which was a highly technical security journal that was published online. That's where they released about remote library injection, which is essentially loading code. It can be like loading code over a network into a process without ever writing it to disk, including loading a DLL into that process. So at this time, you could have like a vulnerability in some network-facing server. That service can get exploited over the network. The DLL that's going to be loaded into memory for the backdoor or to maintain access gets loaded over the network. It sits in memory, gets loaded into the process, and nothing ever writes to disk. So if you did the traditional forensics technique of walk up to a machine, pull the plug, and then look at the disk, it would never be there. You would think nothing happened, but in reality, the entire server was compromised. It just didn't need to interact with the disk to do it.
So it got really hard.
Yeah.
Is that daunting, or do you like that?
No, it's really fun, and I guess one thing that's made it somewhat easier for me to do some of the research I do is I did Linux because there was also another DFRWS challenge that year, I think 2007 and 2008. So I was doing a lot of Linux stuff then. That's all open source, so I can just go read the source code, see what it looks like, and then replicate it through volatility. The majority of Mac is open source as well, but the people doing Windows research all the time, it's really hard because they have to reverse engineer everything that they want. So if they say, okay, I see this process has, let's say, injected a DLL into memory, well, they have to reverse engineer how are DLLs stored in the kernel, how are they referenced in user land, and then they can write their volatility code or whatever memory forensics tool they're using to recover it.
So in the volatility project, is your sort of your focus is Mac and Linux?
My contributions have mostly been Mac, Linux, and then adding the Android support. And then I've done some stuff on the Windows side, but nothing compared to like MHL and Jamie and Aaron. So
you said I see in some of the notes we had talked before this, and you say there's a lot to do on smartphones as well, on tablets and smartphones. What kind of work are you doing to sort of grow that area of forensics?
So we've actually done some work very recently, but it started my friend Joe, who I went to college with, he did his master's on some Android memory forensics, and he wrote a tool to acquire memory, so to take like a physical RAM dump from a phone or a tablet, because mm-hmm. There wasn't a tool at that point to do that. Once he had that tool working and I can actually get memory dumps, that's when I added the Android support into volatility. And at that point, though, all we could analyze was kernel memory. There was no – so you have your Android phone. You can see the processes that are running, the network connections. But if you had something like a browser or the Facebook application, all you could really do was dump the memory for that process. You could do like strings or grep, but it wasn't very sophisticated and wasn't really all that useful to really dig deep into it. And so – but then what happened is So all those applications on Android are powered by what's known as Dalvik. That's the basically the JVM on the Android. It's Google's version of the JVM. So we did. I did some work with Joe's new company. They got one of the Dalvik fast track grants to do it, and we wrote full code to analyze Dalvik. So now instead of just saying this is like the Facebook application in memory, you can dump all the classes out of memory, all the variables, all the functions. You get like the names and the values associated with them. So it's everything that is basically everything that the JVM knows about the running application volatility now can understand and parse. So we have really deep memory forensics capabilities on Android now.
So, Andrew, go ahead, Liam. When you look at the things like the Karna botnet, you know, which was a botnet of embedded devices, specifically a lot of network IP cameras, you know, what does the future look like for, you know, possibly doing, you know, memory forensics on a variety of embedded devices? Because it seems like everything just runs Linux these days.
Yeah, and that actually, that's interesting. We've had a few people contact us about that. We know some people have added those into memory forensics tools, but haven't been able to release it public. But it's really, if it's Linux, that's always a good start. And then really the only thing you have to do from there is write support for translating virtual addresses on that architecture. So all I had to do, like when I wrote the Linux support, it supported Intel by default. That's what I tested against. To add Android support, all I had to do was write one file of Python that knew how to take a virtual address in the Linux kernel memory, and then translate that to a physical offset for ARM. So I know people have done the same thing for MIPS because there's quite a few Linux devices that run that. So if it's Linux, it's really just getting support for the architecture, which all it takes is sitting with the architecture manual and how pages are translated and then coding that into volatility. It's pretty straightforward.
Is there also going to be a challenge on pulling memory images from these devices though as well?
Yeah, it depends how they're exported. Luckily, Android or most Android devices have support for loadable kernel modules. You obviously need elevated privileges. You need to be root for that to happen. But there's not a whole lot of ways around that from a software perspective. If you're lucky to have a device with like FireWire or something, you can exploit that. I'm not really a hardware guy, but I know with like JTAG, people have processes to pull memory on certain devices that way. That's the hard thing. If your interface is just, you know, a screen and you get two buttons and you have no access to anything, then it's definitely difficult. But assuming you can access memory and you have the memory dump, it's just writing support for the architecture that it's running on.
So what do you think about the advances in malware, how it's evolved over the years?
It's really interesting. It's kind of, security has the same thing, I guess, like the cat and mouse game where, you know, like AV signatures have been dead a long time, so people try to do monitor the runtime behavior, and then once certain things are, you know, once I guess that would be the defensive security products knew that certain registry keys meant something and writing to certain files and hooking, you know, like if you try to hook the system call table, all that's very loud and obvious, and then now security has gone way beyond that. And I think since this forensics community actually has researchers that can keep up with the malware now. The malware is just getting more and more advanced to try to hide, essentially, and not be immediately detected. Or even just, I mean, even like in a memory dump when it's off the system, you know, they still want ways that we're not going to be able to figure it out. So,
Do you find it depressing? Or I mean,
no, it's interesting. I mean, if the malware was just stagnant and didn't come up with interesting things, we wouldn't have a whole lot to do from a research perspective. So it's fun to see.
So what are a couple of the scariest or most creative advances in malware that you've seen in the last couple of years?
Good question, Liam. Yeah, let's talk about that.
So one push that's been really interesting is we tell people this sort of in like a arrogant or, you know, joking, sarcastic way. It's like once you – basically you can't hide from memory, right? Like the malware has to do something in memory. So once you get a memory dump, eventually you're going to find the malware if you have the skills to do that. So what quite a few malware samples are doing is trying to prevent you from getting a memory getting memory acquired in the first place, or if you're going to acquire memory, to not get a correct version of it. And some of the most interesting examples I saw of this, Joanna, I would butcher her last name if I tried to say it, Joanna spoke at Black Hat 2007 on stopping physical memory acquisition. So you have protocols like FireWire and like the piece, those the express slots on laptops that give you direct mm-hmm. access to like the bus to get physical memory. So what she did is she actually it's a really interesting talk. I can't explain it in like 5 minutes, but essentially what she did is on the newer AMD chipsets, they have memory in and out ranges, so you have protected ranges to actual devices like you would normal like virtual addressing. And so what she did is she remapped some of those registers so that when you went to read the physical address of like where her malware was, she just redirected it somewhere else. And this was done essentially at like the chipset level. And so even over FireWire or some other hardware protocol, you weren't able to correctly acquire memory. And
What do you do?
There's really not a whole lot to do at that point, unfortunately.
If you had like a loadable kernel module on the device, though, you would still be able to access the correct memory, right? That just mitigated the ability to extract it over hardware, right?
It should be because this was like 5 years ago or something. I believe she was just remapping the hardware address ranges, so I don't think that would work from software. And the whole point of her attack was that. So people said, okay, we can do this in software, but you know the malware has the same permissions as your tool, so they can interfere with you. So people move the hardware, and then her whole point was, hey, we can defeat hardware too if we can defeat hardware acquisition too if we really want to.
You got to get us the link for that, so because
it was a really cool paper. And then there's been some other ones that were software based attacks. There was one at the big conference CCC. I think it's in Germany every year. Mm-hmm. The Chaos Communication, a guy did a talk on defeating, basically he wanted to defeat volatility and other memory analysis tools by wiping any remnants of his malware from the memory dump. So what he did was he hooked certain parts, of the kernel, the running operating system, and then what he did is as memory was being acquired, he looked for pages that were associated with like his process structures and so on, and wiped those out of memory. So by the time you get the memory dump, even though his malware was active on the machine, you're not going to see it when you're doing memory forensics.
Well, isn't this sort of like an Achilles heel about memory forensics, is that if you're relying on any of the internal operating system structures on a compromised box, the possibility that you're relying on compromised code?
Right, and that's why one of the things I always talk about, I definitely stressed it at the RSA talk, is not to do live forensics. So don't walk up to a machine and try to run sysinternals or some other like incident response kit that gives you like processes and network connections, because all those will be hidden. So what these tools are now doing, though, as you said, is they're hooking the APIs that are involved with acquiring memory to stop that. And so That talk at CCC did that very successfully. There's also something interesting that we have people actually kind of figure out by hand in our volatility training, which is the Windows kernel has a large number of callbacks, which callbacks for different events. And so you can say, every time this event happens, I want my code to be able to run, so you can know something's happening. And one of those callbacks is for when a crash dump is being created. And a crash dump is Microsoft's debugging format, memory dump format, that you can load into WinDebug. And so one of the callbacks says a crash dump's being written, and the purpose of that is for the thing that receives the callback to add extra information into the crash dump, so it can say, hey, I was doing this, the machine's crashing, and then that way you have extra debug information. But there were some malware samples that said, hey, a crash dump's being created. If I let this get written out to disk, you know, the investigator will be able to see the malware in memory. So the malware at that point wipes itself from memory, then it lets the crash dump process continue, and then when you actually end up with the crash dump, the malware is not there again. So it's just fighting the idea. It's not even trying to hide from you in memory perspective. It's just not going to let itself get written out to the memory dump.
So are you also seeing malware dumps hide from things like, you know, hibernation files on disk?
I don't know if I've seen anything that hooks like the hibernation code. I don't remember explicitly seeing anything that hooks the hibernation code. There's also some other techniques. Like, we have so the way we actually do memory forensics, our preferred way is with a product called F-Response, which it exports the disk and memory read-only over like a basically an iSCSI channel. And you can, on your Linux machine, you can mount that as like an iSCSI device, and then you have access to memory, and then you can acquire it that way. The other way is if we're in a virtualized environment, you can just snapshot the virtual machine, and then you get a pristine copy of RAM as it was when the virtual machine was running, and malware that's running in one of the guests isn't going to be able to interfere with the process on the host. So that's probably one of the cleanest ways to acquire memory without worrying about exactly what's going on in the guest at the time.
With snapshots on virtual machines, are you seeing an increasing trend about virtual machine-aware malware?
No, that's actually gone down quite a bit, and I actually saw an interesting talk recently with statistics on that. Because the idea is, before, virtual machines were just used by, or were commonly used by, researchers to analyze malware without it destroying their drive. But now you see environments where 50, 60, 70% of the environment is just virtualized servers, and if the malware would see the virtual machine and not do anything, then that's like 70% of their what they actually want to target, they're not going to execute on. So just a straight VM detection and then exit, or VM detection and then like trash the machine, that's not really common anymore. But we have seen some interesting there has been some interesting malware recently. I was reading about it because the developers of the Cuckoo sandbox added support for it. So what this malware does is it does the check, so it'll do the VMware check, but it won't, or the virtual machine checks, but it won't exit after that. Instead, what it will do, it will sit there until something that mimics a normal user happens. So it'll kind of just sit in a suspended state until it sees the mouse being clicked, or something being typed on the keyboard, or the mouse moved, because then they know it's a real user instead of just being in a sandbox environment where it's supposed to run and everything's monitored and then it goes away.
That's awesome. That's really
incredible. So this is like the malware conducting a Turing test against the virtual machine to see if there's a user there.
Yeah, exactly. So
that's really good.
So what the Cuckoo guys did, which I guess I didn't really explain what that was. Cuckoo Sandbox is an open source sandbox. Is very powerful. They've now integrated with Volatility, so you can do automated memory capture and analysis inside of it. And what they do now is essentially once the machine boots and the malware is going to kick off, they have code that forces like the mouse to be clicked and things to be typed on the keyboard as if someone was there, specifically for those malware samples who are using that to see what type of machine they were on.
So when you go to a company, do they think that you're just ultra paranoid or making some of this up? I mean, do they actually believe? We've been getting – this has gotten really nerdy. I mean, we're over – we've broken the nerd meter right now. And, I mean, do they actually believe that malware can do some of this? Do you have to convince them or demonstrate it for them?
I mean, sometimes they like to hear the stories and they kind of just have like a – I've never had anyone like not really believe it. But at the same time, it's not really where – at least – in my position, I mean, I guess other people could. It's not really where you're walking in and like something hasn't already happened. If someone's bringing you in before they've actually been had like a network intrusion, that means they're already proactive enough and they want something to happen anyway. And then if they bring you in once they already had a network intrusion, there's not a whole lot of them really harassing you with questions. It's just they want you to get, you know, figure out what happened. So I guess I've never really been in the position to try to like convince someone of the. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Right, yeah. So I guess my question is, a lot of people try to do it themselves. Mm-hmm. What's your feeling on that?
Okay, so I know you have a lot of system administrators that listen to this, and hopefully I don't offend anyone, but system administrators have been essentially the biggest pain to me in forensics many times, and I'll explain that. But from a forensic side, it's been painful because we sort of talked about before all the strict requirements on you know, you have to, before you do any forensics, like right when you walk up to a machine, you have to do your acquisition. So if memory is part of that, you need to walk up to the machine, you know, acquire memory, then you need to turn the machine off, then you need to make an image, you know, an exact copy of the disk, not on, you know, without booting it, right? So in some forensics manner. And the big issue, again, we're talking about forensics here, what normally happens is, let's say an employee, they think he's browsing to some website that he shouldn't, or they think, hey, this guy printed out a bunch of sensitive documents. You know, maybe he left them in the tray or whatever. Let's see if they're really on his machine. Let's see what he was doing with them.
Oh, and, does that violate chain of custody?
Yeah, so this is the issue. A sysadmin will, you know, remote desktop in, or will go sit on the machine, or someone from HR will go click around on the desktop and open files and browse through the email, and this causes a lot of issues. One big issue is for some resources, like depending on what kind of document it is and so on, or what type of file, you might only have one copy of the last time that document was accessed or the last time that document was modified. And if someone gets on the machine, looks around the document, or say they see the file on the desktop and then they open it to read it, well, that's going to update that access time to when it was the HR person instead of when it's the person you're investigating.
Right.
Same thing if they delete files or they move files. So then when you go back to do your investigation, you can't just do a straightforward investigation. You have to look at every action and say, you know, was this the HR person or was this the person I'm investigating? And you have to be able to prove that, because if you screw that up in your report and you go to court and you say, you know, this person accused of whatever they did this, and he goes, no, I didn't, and then it's later proven, it goes back to the same thing, right? Like your evidence will be thrown out. You'll be, you know, you won't look quite like an expert at that point. And so it's a big issue. And I mean, we've had many cases where we speak, you know, a company will call us out of the blue and say, hey, we need forensics. And we talk to them about what happened, you know, between when they figured it out and when they called us. And we just tell them, look, you know, we'll do the investigation, but if your end goal is to take this person to court, you know, we're not going to waste your time because you destroyed the evidence already.
So if you could give us one piece of advice, would it be to treat, if you think that something's going on a machine, a system or something, to treat it like a crime scene? Like put the yellow caution tape, but sort of a logical kind of putting like the crime tape around it.
That's exactly what needs to happen. And going back to the companies that are proactive, you know, we had agreements with companies like this when I was at a past job, and I know all the forensics companies have these. And you know, if you have an agreement in place with the forensics company already, and you say, "Hey, something happens, send your guys out." They're only going to bill you, you know, a few hours just to preserve the machine, to take the memory capture, to take the disk image correctly. And then if it turns out that, hey, we don't need to investigate this person or we misunderstood something, all you're doing is paying a company for maybe 3 or 4 or 5 billable hours and all that evidence preserved if you do investigate them. So it's not really a big investment, and you have evidence that you can use going forward, you know, if you decide that it's necessary.
You know, that's a really good point. So you're saying it's better if you think that if something is not right, if you think that something may not be right, it's better to bring somebody like you in. I mean, as much as the sysadmins and maybe the network admins and some of the in-house security resent it, I mean, this is very labor intensive to go through, and a lot of places just don't have those resources. So you're saying it's better to maybe just call you guys in, you know, pull the memory, pull the disk, and then and get what you need, and then you know, you wait for them to tell you if they should pull the trigger, and then at least the evidence is preserved. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Yeah, and you have you know, forensics companies, it's trying to kind of blanking on the term on the contract, but you have like evidence storage agreements. So you say, you know, we'll take the hard drives, we're going to make our copies of it, and we'll store it for, you know, 90 days or 6 months for free. And then if you call us 4 months later and you say, hey, let's start the investigation, well, now we have that preserved evidence. Or if you say, you know, hey, this guy, you know, we looked into this person, they weren't doing what we thought they were, can you just destroy that evidence because we're not going to move forward with the investigation?
So that's a good point. You have attorneys on retainer, you have accountants, things like that. Why not have a forensics company on retainer?
Yeah, and as I said, you know, especially incident response forensics, something like an hour or a day or 2 days can make a huge difference. And depending on the size of the company and the, you know, relationship between the people involved, if it takes a week or two to kick things back and forth between lawyers, well, all that evidence could be gone. It could be overwritten.
Right.
And so it's much nicer if you just have someone you can call in and they say, you know, I'll be there the next morning, or they can send at least one person out, like, you know, the same day.
I mean, out in the field, you hear stories and you talk to organizations or places where I've worked, and you just see how I mean, I don't even do this on a day-to-day basis, but I see how evidence gets trashed. And, you know, in my mind, I always think of it as sort of that it's – if something has happened on a system, I think of it as being contaminated. And that that's been contaminated with some bad disease like Ebola or, you know, leprosy. And how can it be contained away from everything else? But unfortunately, there will know that system's live and it's legacy and there's only one. And, you know, they won't let you do anything. And it's, you know, the way you talk, it's probably a good idea to try to integrate that kind of process into your incident response plan.
So, Andrew, is there a particular professional organization or seal of approval that people should look for if they need to shop for these kind of services?
I don't know of any. If we're talking civil here, like it gets a lot different with criminal, and that's normally like the police or the FBI, which is not my realm of expertise. But on this, like on something that's going to start civil or where you're just bringing someone in to start, there's no real like company approval that I've heard of or that we've ever been asked to show.
There's no Consumer Reports for this?
I don't think so.
We should start one.
But there are some individual things that can be helpful. There are certifications in forensics that can show like a baseline. But I know I've been, you know, me myself and people that I've been working with have been interviewed by companies before. You know, they would some a lot of times before they would sign those agreements we were talking about to come in. Like when something happens, you probably want to request the resume of someone. But I know I'm dealing with a company that's like very proactive and knowing what they're doing. If they're like, we want to talk to who's ever going to be the lead on this project. And then if you have a set of questions to ask them, like, okay, when you walk up to my machine, what are you going to do? How are you going to store the evidence? What type of artifacts are you going to produce? If you have any type of specialized environment, like if you're totally an Oracle shop or totally a Microsoft SQL shop or any of the other sort of specialized technologies, you can ask them, you know, have you been in these environments doing forensics before? What special steps do you take to accommodate for that?
Well, what certs, for example, what certifications are there out there?
Let's see. There's some from...
Because you have the SANS certification, is that correct?
Yeah, I have the GCFA, which I think is GICA Forensics Analyst. I think is the acronym. They have some other, like they have an incident response one. I think they have like a Windows specific incident response one as well, like a Windows forensics one.
I'm putting you on the spot because we're not very nice about certs here sometimes.
I think GIAC is the biggest provider of like forensics related certifications.
Okay.
I know I'm going to go read someone's signature later in an email and see one that I forgot or something, but
no, that's okay. So
that's normally kind of what I see. The CISSP, I know that's big. That's not really like technical enough to show like the hands-on skills you would want to see. The ICS2 people that do CISSP, they just within like the last 2 weeks released a forensic certification. So I doubt there's anyone except maybe like the beta people that would have that.
Yeah, I just saw that. I was interested in that. It seems like though it focuses on the legal aspect of forensics, like the
it has a lot of legal stuff in there, and then I guess just sort of I was looking at the outline and there was like nothing about memory forensics, so of course I didn't like that too much. But that's also kind of weird to me because like memory forensics is such an important thing. But yeah, that one's so new that no one would have an opinion on it. It's only been like 2 or 3 weeks or something. So
we started down this road kind of talking about, you know, an increasing demand for companies shopping for forensic services. You know, it seems like with recent guidance from the SEC about, actually reporting risks in IT, you know, break-ins and so forth, do you see regulation affecting your business, either, you know, business being like what you do, positively or negatively?
I guess probably I'm fortunate enough to not have had to deal with that directly. I have friends who do are in sort of like leadership security roles in financial and health, and they've had a lot of the same requirements for a long time now that are kind of getting rolled into more companies in other sectors. I think the are the specific SEC things that you're referring to, are those just like the data breach notifications, or is that actual like checking like what a company's doing security-wise?
Because I know there was the data breach guidance. You know, I just see an increasing trend for all the regulatory bodies out there to, you know, increase mandatory reporting with, you know, possible, you know, violation charge, you know, possible consequences for not reporting that stuff. So I'm wondering if companies are, you know, when they have incidents, are they actually following through on the incidents, or are they saying, well, this may lead to a reportable event, we should just bury this?
I wonder that myself, because
yeah,
it's
I think
certainly
that's,
not pretty.
I think that's bordering like NDA land for a lot of people. But
that answers my question well enough.
I think so too. Yeah.
Okay.
Have you actually encountered that, Andrew, where you go in and you give them a bad piece of news and they're like, okay, check please. I think you can go now.
Kind of. I mean, we've had companies that definitely want to bury it and aren't going to go call like CNN or something to announce it. It just gets really tricky because sometimes it's hard to report. I mean, a lot of it's like people's personal information. And then a lot of times it's hard too. I'm not really informed enough to start a debate on the whole disclosure thing. But some of the things I saw were like, you know, you have 72 hours, 96 hours to disclose. And that's really fast forensics. Like, I mean,
yeah.
Not many people can do forensics fast enough to give what's like a fully like flushed out factual report of an incident on a, you know, what could be a huge network, especially when you're talking about companies where these breach notifications would actually be, you know, nationwide or you know, even international.
The PCI notifications are very fast. That's what you're referring to, right?
Yeah, and then even just some of the data breach notification laws that were proposed, and you know, they had like 3-day windows, and you know, going back to kind of our earlier conversation, what if you don't have agreement in place with a IR or a forensics company? You know, are you really going to like get contracts signed, people on site, and you know, this full on report so that you're giving like your shareholders and whoever else, you know, factual information 3 days later? That's really hard. But at the same time, if you say, hey, you got 6 months, then everyone's just going to sit on it and, you know, probably never do it anyway. So I guess I kind of see both sides of it. But I've also I haven't had to deal firsthand with the SEC stuff yet, but I've seen it in quite a few other sectors where they have those type of requirements. So,
well, with the depositions you've done, though, the bar to actually say definitively whether something did or did not happen is actually very high, isn't it?
Yeah, especially on the forensic side, there's a lot you have to go through to do that.
And do you feel, are there some cases where you're working on them and you are only 80% sure? I mean, are there situations where you're just not sure?
There can be, and you need to be, from like a reporting standpoint, you need to be very, very clear about that, because the worst thing you can do is say something as like absolute valid truth and then you get proved wrong later. So you just need to clearly specify, like, I saw this behavior, you know, it indicates this, but there was no other artifacts that like corroborated it. That's kind of the normal thing, at least where I've not been able to prove definitively.
Is like Dragnet. It's like Dragnet, just the facts.
Yeah. You'll have a lot of issues in court and lawyers and everywhere else if you try to like throw an opinion, or if you just say, you know, hey, I saw this one random thing and nothing else, you know, kind of led me to the same conclusion, but I'm just going to run with it. So.
Yeah, that must be – is that scary for you? Do you get a little nervous when you're writing up those reports?
In the beginning, it was interesting. It's kind of – it's better now, and I guess I'm also lucky enough that I do a lot more incident response, which means not as like strict of legal reports. But yeah, it's definitely – you definitely read the report quite a few times before you like, you know, send it anywhere outside of your computer. So
now that we've like basically convinced people that they really need to be careful if they're that they should probably bring somebody in if it's if it looks like it might be pretty dangerous or pretty all-encompassing. If that being said, if there are people out there who want to get started in the field and who maybe they're just doing incident response and they're not doing the forensic side, what are some of the free tools out there that can get you started? I mean, there's obviously volatility, which that's the number one tool that we want everyone to use, right?
Yes. there's many open source tools. As I said, I do basically all my investigation with different open source tools. From the disk forensics standpoint, the Sleuthkit, which has been around forever, is definitely the best tool for like the disk level, the file system level. Brian Carrier's book, File System Forensics Analysis, is the best-selling forensics book ever by far. So really, everyone in forensics should know the tool, should have used it. On the registry side of things, there's Harlan's set of tools called Registry Ripper, RegRipper. He's also written quite a few books. The latest two that he did, though, that would be – I would highly recommend these books are one is his Windows Forensics Analysis book, and then he has an entire book on registry forensics. And then, as I said before, myself and Vico and Joe wrote Registry Decoder, which is another registry forensics tool. I know many, many people use that. We've had like several thousand downloads off the Google code page. On the network side, everyone basically uses Wireshark and then writing code around the PCAP format that it supports.
Bro, of course, Bro is
yes.
good. We want to plug Bro. We love Bro.
Yes. let's see.
And what do you think of – so there – I've seen some Linux distros out there. There's Remnux, of course. What have you? Do you use that at all? Or
I've used it a few times. That's one instance where I don't really where I like switch to Windows for malware stuff, so I can use like the reversing tools on Windows, especially like when I actually want to run something or use IDA. There's a new distribution that seems really interesting. It's called Kali Linux, Kali.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
it's based off Backtrack, and they kind of rolled some forensic stuff into it. I also really like it because I guess it's a decision that every forensics live CD person or Linux distribution has to make. But it does it where so you're booting off like a CD or a USB drive, right? Mm-hmm. And then all the other drives that are attached to the machine, it doesn't do anything with them when they boot. It doesn't auto mount them. It doesn't do anything with them. It just, you know, the device nodes get created. And then from there, if you want to mount it, you can choose exactly how you want it, like read-only, or if it's something you're writing to, you can do it read-write. The problem is some of the other Linux forensics distributions mount the drive as normal. So if you plug like an Evidence drive directly into the machine, and then you boot that CD, it's going to mount the drive. That's going to change the hash. And particularly when you have when you have hardware that can't go into a write blocker, so like a little USB thumb drive or some USB enclosures, there's no write blockers that I know of, at least for those. So I just use one of those live CDs that don't mount the drive and then stick the thumb drive in and you know, copy them. So and then a lot of other people work that way as well. So those ones that like auto mount stuff just kind of drive me crazy, and I avoid those. So
okay, so we gave props to we definitely gave props to Kali Linux, and I've been playing around with that, and yeah, I'm really liking what they've done with that, you know, that upgrade to Backtrack. So what is coming up for you? What do you think the new trends in forensics and incident response are that we need to pay attention to?
So definitely malware is getting more advanced. Like, it's not just me saying it as being a volatility person. There's been plenty of people saying if you want like the latest skills in the field, like memory forensics is the way to do it, whether you use volatility or any other tool. But having memory forensics skills is going to be one of the most sought after things. Another one, which we kind of touched on in the beginning, is that it's not just Windows anymore. So even if you're in an environment where they're all Windows servers, all, you know, every employee has some Windows installed on their laptop or their desktop, well, what about their phones? You know, Android is Linux. The iPhones are running what's basically sort of, you know, essentially iOS, right? Like some Mac operating system. And so if you've never seen anything but Windows before, what are you going to do when you get a disk image of an Android phone or a disk image of an iPhone? You know, there's no Windows registry. There's no event logs. So people need to start really understanding more operating systems than just Windows. And then also on the IR side, we've seen quite a few, you know, huge Linux networks breached. And so they brought our team in specifically because we have like known Linux incident response experience and skills. But if you're a person that's only done Windows before, it's a whole new thing, right? It's like learning an entire other operating system, a whole new set of artifacts. So I think that's a lot of it. Android malware is getting very, very interesting. The capabilities they have are very interesting, and it's becoming a lot more prevalent as, you know, Android's basically taken over the mobile market. So
is that your hobby, like looking at malware in the evenings?
Yeah.
You get a glass of wine and then you're looking at malware. Hi, honey, yeah. I'm gonna go look at malware.
Yeah, particularly since we worked on all that Dalvik stuff, it lets us get some really deep insight into Android malware, what the Android malware is doing without actually doing anything, no reversing or anything. It's all done through volatility. And then
does it make you all warm and fuzzy inside to look at malware?
Yeah. And then who was it? Was it Trend Micro or maybe it was F-Secure? One of the big security vendors they traced down one piece of malware that was used against like Tibetan activists, I believe, and it had some really interesting capabilities. They had the one that another company just dubbed like the most notorious Android malware yet, and they did a write-up on it. And so you're seeing some now that people are actually looking for Android malware, you're seeing the authors become very creative to try to like avoid detection and avoid reverse engineering, which is interesting because it's the same thing you saw happen on Windows once, you know, forensics people actually started looking.
Well, what do you do to prevent – I mean, what kind of personal computer security and phone security do you use? Are you ultra-paranoid?
I'm fairly paranoid, I think. I mean, as far as physical security, I have disk encryption, and then I have, like, containers inside of the already encrypted disk. Network-wise, I have – have like a multi-NIC Linux box that's as my router, and then there's like different segmented networks behind that, so like random guests can't get on the same network, same subnet as me and all that. And then there's a wireless for everything else, and then I kind of have my own subnet that goes directly to the internet without anyone else being able to interfere.
I also have my wife on her own VLAN as well, so I feel your pain.
Yeah.
We hope that she's not listening, Liam.
She's not listening. She's not going to listen. I'm sorry. I love my wife, and she's a techno noob. Sorry. We can move on.
Well, Andrew, it's really been it's been great having you on the show, and it's been very edifying for me personally. Liam, I know you mostly focus on intrusion detection, so I think you've gotten a lot out of it as well.
There might be a minor bromance here.
Yeah, I know.
I'm certainly interested.
I know. I was just geeking out during the whole thing. There are 8 million stories in the city of healthy paranoia. This has been one of them. Please remember to follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers, fraternize with our listeners on IRC at Freenode, or join the LinkedIn gang. Visit packetpushers.net to read the blogs by growing Packet Pusher detainees, subscribe to our RSS feeds, join our crew at the user forum, and donate to the show, because the only thing more expensive than firewalls are lawyers. Email your comments or questions about the show to packetpushers@gmail.com or healthyparanoia@packetpushers.net. And remember, it's healthy paranoia because sometimes they really are out to get you.